2, Board of Commissioners meeting, special session for deep dive into the proposed budget. And this is being held in accordance with Governor Inslee's COVID-19 rules. It is being officially audio recorded, and the time shown on the agenda is for an estimate only. And we will go ahead and begin with the budget session. So Mike, do you have anything that you'd like to say as we begin?
Yes, to introduce Tyler, and whom you all know really well, that this was the first Jefferson Healthcare budget that he put together. And just to really test his mettle, we had him do it in the middle of a pandemic. But I think started early and lots of interactions and input with department directors, a remarkably well understanding of the basic operation tenets of Jefferson Healthcare and sort of the nuanced operational tenets of Jefferson Healthcare, and kind of successfully navigated to what I think you'll agree is a very solid budget. Complicating things again is what do you use as a baseline to project 2022 volumes and expenses and just all of the variables that we need to understand. So we always say that budgets are estimates, and the one thing we can be certain about is that they will be wrong. There's probably a bigger plus or minus range with every hospital budget this year as we just step into 2022 without having real clear line of sight on how things are going to look. But all that being said, it's a great product, and Tyler did a terrific job. So, Tyler, take it away.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Mike. So, I am Tyler Freeman. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of Jefferson Healthcare. We are going to go through the 2022 budget. This is the operating budget and our capital budget. If you go to the next slide, I'll kind of outline how this is going to look. So, first off, we'll just set the landscape, go a little bit over our budget philosophy and some of the things that are driving the 2022 budget. Then we'll go into the operating budget. First, in summary, we'll just look at the income statement overall and then dive into some key performance indicators that we have, and then also the departmental statistics that are driving the changes in revenue that we're seeing and expense for the budget. And then we also have a capital and projects list for 2022 through 2025. And then if you have any questions, please just stop me throughout. We don't have to wait till the end. There will probably be plenty of time at the end as well, but feel free to stop me whenever. So next slide. So first off, as I said, we're just going to set the table here. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about to do that was just to start off by going over the need for healthy finances. And we're going to be looking at growth in services and then also some community benefit as part of that. We'll look at our budget process, the philosophy and key themes that we had in the 2022 budget, a little bit of vocabulary, and then look at tax revenue, both from our estimated tax revenue and then just a look at our surrounding area and tax revenues that they have. Next slide. So as I said, one of the key things that I think is important to remember is why why is it important to have a margin in healthcare? And one of the things that that gets you is growing services for your community. So this is not an all-inclusive list, but you can see from 2011 to 2019, some of the key services that were brought online. And then it's pretty remarkable looking at the growth in net patient service revenue from 2011 to 2021 annualized. It's more than doubled in those 10 years. And even looking at 2020, I think is pretty interesting to see that with all that was going on, we still almost were at 2019's net patient service revenue, just slightly below it, rounding difference between the two of them at both at 117 million. And we're projecting to be at 147 million at the end of 2022. So still having that continued growth, still a lot of it is, it doesn't all have to be new services. There's a lot of service expansion that goes on, bringing on new providers, bringing on new services within the department. So we're continually trying to grow to meet the needs of the community, and what that does helps keep people within your health system, which then we can kind of hold some of our other costs and prices down if we're able to just keep folks in our community receiving their care here. And we can do that by expanding the services we offer. And then the next slide goes over our other community benefits that we have. So these numbers are for 2020 and 2019. And you can see pretty significant numbers all across the board, but $6 million in those 2 years of free and discounted care. So that's the charity care that we've went over just recently at one of the board meetings to discuss how that is for our indigent patients and how we have a more generous charity care policy than is actually required of us from the state law. It's important to note that $6 million, we don't receive any funding for that. That's not funded at the state level. That's not funded at the federal level. That's funded by the hospital. So that being able to offer that discount and offer it at a more generous level than we're required is important to us, but we do not receive any additional funding for that. So we have to make that up in other areas to subsidize that expense. The uncompensated care, the $7 million worth of bad debt, that's different from that first category we looked at. This, instead of at a simplistic view, the first one is patients who cannot pay their bills, and the second one is patients who are unwilling to pay their bills. They do not meet our criteria for receiving free or discounted care, but they have not paid their bill. We have exhausted all collection efforts, and we were not able to collect that funding. Now, for uncompensated care, we do receive some monies back, some funding from Medicare for that. So for non-Medicare patients, again, that has to be subsidized through other means. But for Medicare, they do receive some, or they do provide some level of funding for uncompensated care. And then I also wanted to point out the $1.7 million worth of reimbursed employee patient responsibility. So that is a benefit that we provide. I'm not too sure that, I don't know if there's any research on this. If I don't believe it's a common thing. I've never heard of it during my time at auditing. It definitely was not at my last hospital, or else my kid would have cost me a lot less to have in the hospital. But we actually provide any care that a Jefferson Healthcare employee receives at Jefferson Healthcare, they do not have to foot the bill for that patient responsibility that's outstanding. So their copay, their deductibles, their coinsurance, we cover that when they have their procedures done at Jefferson, which is a huge benefit to employees. I mean, not only does that help out for childbirth, but it helps out if you're going to the emergency room, if you need a knee surgery. All of those that would typically be very costly procedures that the individual would have to take on that burden all alone, we cover that for them. And that's in addition to having great benefits on top of that.
Yeah, that number typically runs about $1 million a year. Our thinking is that it ran as a typical million in 2019, and then just like as a provider of care, we noticed a reduction of services in 2020. Well, I think our employees, as consumers of care, consumed less healthcare services in 2020, and therefore the in rough numbers, I think the amount of hospital either payment of responsibility or waiving of responsibility lessened too. But I agree with Tyler. I'm not aware of this benefit being offered by another hospital.
So if there's no additional questions on this, as like I said, I know we just went over both charity and bad debt at length at the last commissioner's meeting, but we can move on to the next slide. So our budget process followed a similar approach that we've used in the past. One of the things that we do when we're preparing for the budget is we actually train a group of super users. These are users outside of the finance department. So these are leaders who are going to be preparing their own budget in addition to being liaison helper for others that are going to be completing their budget. And one of the reasons we use this kind of train the trainer approach is because it gives a different perspective. If we have leaders only asking their questions, their budget questions to the finance department, we're going to have a very financially focused answer back. And so having other departmental leaders be the super users that can, they can bounce ideas off of, they can ask questions of their budget, that gives them a more operational perspective when they look at it. And finance is going to do the deep dive and send their questions back regardless. So it's really nice to have that operational perspective when having the super users. So in July, we get our overall philosophies, we train the super users, we send some material out for leaders to think about their overall approach, and then we prepare the budget packet so they can be released. And then in August, this is when the leaders are going to go in. They're going to complete their budget packet, work with their senior leader to make sure that they've put everything in correctly, that they're thinking about all of the new strategies that are going to be implemented into the next year. And they also meet with those super users to bounce ideas off of and just get another level of review. And once they finalize all of that, accounting takes all of these various budget packets, which are Excel documents, and then compiles them all into one master file. And that master file is what feeds into our income statement that we're going to look at today and our statistics that we're going to look at today. So there's a considerable amount of effort that it takes to do the budget in the first place, but then we've got to glue it all together, review everything, make sure that we've got all of the numbers in accurately. And then once we do that, we start to add the capital and re-review it and send questions out. I think I sent every SLG, if they would have printed the email, probably would have been a multi-page emails worth of questions, because it was my first time going through it with these departments. So just to make sure that I understood all of the volume and expense assumptions that were going into the budget, there was a lot of back and forth, a lot of questions, and a lot of work that was put into the budget that you all are going to see today. We have this hearing, and then on our next Wednesday, we will do the budget approval. So I can't stress enough how much effort it is to do all of this. A lot of effort from the original budget preparer side, from the SLG that is helping their preparer go through it, from accounting, and my part of it is probably the least amount of effort given all of the work that goes into it before it even gets to me. It's been reviewed by a lot of folks, so a lot of work goes into these, and we try and get the most reasonable numbers that we can, knowing, like Mike said, that everything we show you today will not be accurate. But we've definitely, you know, done our due diligence and tried to set it up in line with our philosophies and strategies going into the next year. So next slide. So our general approach for the budget that we outlined for all of the preparers was just we need to remain vigilant in managing costs and to try and shoot for margin improvement. In some areas that may not be possible, but as much as we can for each and every department, we try to go in and make sure that we had a little bit better of a margin than we did in the previous year. And we knew going into the 2022 budget that the volumes are likely going to be better than 2021, but they're still going to be highly variable. It's going to be hard for us to get our arms around what those numbers are going to be. We tried to use a lot of data points when coming up with these numbers. So there's comparisons to the past. There's comparisons to market data to show where we think we may land if we follow trends that the nation is expecting for our specific population. But those numbers are very hard for us to estimate right now. I think healthcare is always challenging, and it seems to be even more nuanced and difficult to get your arms around now. We also have the staffing challenges, which staffing, not only does that impact our salary line, but that impacts our volume line. And if you don't have employees in all of these positions, it's going to be hard to get the volumes that you expect. So we have, as you'll see when we go through the FTE numbers, we have considerable jump in FTEs, and some of that's what's driving the volumes as well. We expect, you know, if we can get a few more people in some roles, maybe we can get some extra movement through in some areas. We did book an overall 3% price increase, but that number is not set in stone. We are working to get a third party to review our prices. We don't, even though talking with other CFOs, it seems like the approach to beat all of this price inflation and the staffing challenges that are causing additional salary expense, additional overtime to be paid out, is to raise prices. And I would expect a 3% looks a little paltry compared to where everyone else is expecting their price increase to be. But we wanted to have a reasonable number there. And we want to have a third party review to make sure that whatever we do is still in line with market and is still reasonable based on what the service that we're being that we're rendering. We don't want to just do a 3% across the board, so that's why we're going to bring in a third party to look at it. And depending on their review, it may be less than 3%. It may be a little bit more. Most contracts allow for 5%, and so it definitely will not be higher than 5. But we're aiming for 3.
Tyler, question?
Yes.
Isn't the inflation rate currently over 5%? At least the last time I checked, it was.
Yeah, our and I think we expect our expenses to be over 5%. You know, with salaries, we expect salaries to rise. We expect supply to increase. So this isn't a beat inflation. It's a let's try and somewhat keep pace with it, knowing that we only have so much wiggle room. As I said, those contracts have a cap, and usually it's anywhere from 3 to 5%. So even if inflation rose 10%, we can't raise our rates 10%, or else we would be out of compliance with our payers.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I think we're in better shape now than we were a handful of years ago with our pricing structure. When we first began looking at this, we were over market pretty much across the board, but particularly in what we call the highly highly consumer sensitivity areas. MRs and CTs and lab tests where patients really did have a choice. So we made that a goal of ours and really stepped on pricing in that in those areas, but also below industry across the board increases kind of year after year after year. And the last check that we did validated that that for the most part we were in kind of right in the middle of the pack, which, you know, our work isn't done, but it felt a hell of a lot better than where we were resting, because, you know, I'm sure that from time to time you hear comments about the cost of an emergency department visit or any service that we provide. Secondly, we've kind of been benefited by that because there has been such low inflation and a relatively stable labor market. But you're exactly right, Case. I think the Social Security passed on like a 5.9% increase, which is, you know, crazy high compared to the last five years where inflation has sort of been kept in check. So if we weren't projecting a significant growth in, you know, in services, which I've always believed the best way to outrun expense creep is on the growth side and the volume side, we probably would be in trouble. But the reason we are able to make this work, at least with the budget document, is a, you know, the 3% increase and a significant uptick in several areas in growth. And as Tyler will review, we think all of that growth projection is fair and reasonable.
All right. Any other questions on this slide? No. All right, we can move ahead. Quickly go through some of these. If there's any others as that we need to do a vocab check on as we're going through, just like I said, stop me and I'll explain what that means. But gross revenue, just charges generated by every department. So our gross revenue numbers are going to have a volume component to it and then a pricing increase component to it this year. Net revenue is what we expect to collect. We generally get 45 cents on the dollar. What is included in the what we're netting against it is those contractual adjustments, and those include the bad debt and charity that we talked about earlier. So those are included in our total write-off amount. One FTE equals 2080 hours. So that's how we've calculated it out. There are some departments where a 0.9 equals a full-time equivalent, but for simplicity's sake, we just take all of the numbers multiply it out by 2080 to get to our total FTE and total hours numbers. And that includes work time and PTO, PSL time. Then the last one, operating total margin. So we have two different margins that we look at in healthcare. And usually you're looking for a 2 to 6% total margin is what we would consider a healthy margin. The calculation for either of those is just your income divided by your revenues. And so if it's operating margin, it's just your operating income. If it's total margin, it's your total change in net position divided by your operating revenues. Next slide. All right, property tax assessment. So we do have two different paths. We can either do the 0% increase, which we've estimated to be about $506,000, or a 1% increase, which is $511,000. Those are just estimates at this point. We are working with the assessor's office to get a meeting scheduled to make sure we have the final number, but it would be about $511,000, which is only 0.3% of our expense budget that would be covered by property tax. And then if you go to the next slide, you can see how our tax revenues compared to those around our region. So Whidbey, about $5.6 million in tax revenue, OMC, $4.6 million, Island, $5.6 million, Mason, $2.3 million, and even Forks, which is considerably smaller in size than us, receives about $700,000 in tax revenue. So all of those are, when you look at it as a percent of operating expenses, even Mason at 1.9% is about five times more tax revenue than we receive on an operating expense basis. And our total amount that we levy is significantly less than what we potentially could by law. But we are projecting for that 1% increase. I think last year we needed to do a substantial need resolution to go along with that because the inflation was not greater than 1%, and we asked for the 1% increase to our tax revenue. We obviously will not need to do that because inflation is much higher than 1%. So even if we ask for the 1%, it would not require a substantial need resolution to go along with it this year.
So there's, I mean, there's all kinds of sound bites around our low tax rate. But one is that because all these organizations have about the same margin at the end of the year, plus or minus a percent or two. We all come in at between 1.5% to 4% operating margins. One way to explain the difference between Whidbey getting $5.6 million and Olympic 4.6 and Anacortes 5.6 is basically those places have a $5 million head start on us before they start setting their prices. Because that's the work. Your prices are a function of your costs offset by revenues. And if you've got a $5 million head start, that will make a meaningful dent on the expenses you need to cover based on your charges. So a couple of years ago, I was telling Tyler there was a lot of sharp discussion about our pricing structure and compared to at least one of the hospitals on this table, and we did speak to a little bit about that that you can we get our revenue through charges and services. Other places get their revenue through charges and services and a significant tax base.
So could I ask, how did they get to where they are? Did they just start adding 1% 40 years ago, and now they're where they are?
No. No, I can speak to Olympic. To go beyond the 1% rate, you have to go to the voters and ask for an increase in your operating levy. And then that, you know, there's a very complicated calculation of, you know, what's the organizational lid and the county lid. That in their case, they just said we need more community support in order to continue doing the things that we're doing. So the short answer, case, is go to the voters.
But that 1% limit hasn't always been in effect. At some point, they probably were able to raise it higher without specifically going to the voters, like you do have to now if you're going to go over 1% increase.
Yeah, that was a Tim Iman thing, and I can't remember. I think it's been at least 2010, but I can't remember, Bruce, what the mechanism was. I know that it was after 2007 when Olympic went to their voters for an increase in their operating levy, but I think there must have been some lid on what you could pass as a function of your budgeting process, but I'll be darned if I know what that is.
Yeah, and as I mentioned too, I think we're sitting at around 4 cents per thousand of assessed value, and the max amount that we can levy is 75 cents. Obviously, you would have to go to the voters to move anywhere close to that from where we're at now, but that's a huge difference from where we're at to the maximum allowable. Especially when you think of, we have about $7 billion worth of assessed property value and underneath the hospital now that we can levy taxes on. So there's a lot out there that we are not needing to use to support our organization that others are. So if we go on to the next one, I think we're jumping right into the operating budget now. So this will, as I said, this will be income statement, some of those key indicators, the operating margin, salary, expense, and then some of the stats that got us to the income statement that we're seeing. So next slide. So from left to right, what you have here is 2018, 19, 20, and 21 annualized. And the annualized data is from June 30th annualized. And you have the old years in there, so we can kind of do a comparison to see how we're trending and tracking on all of these numbers. And then the orange is the 2022 budget. After that is the difference between the 2021 annualized number actual to the 2022 budget. So you can see we have, for the patient revenues, both of those are about 6%, 6.5% higher from a volume standpoint. And then we added the 3% price increase on top to get to about I think it's a 9.9, just shy of 10% increase in total patient revenue. So again, that's about 6-7% is volume, 3% is price. Going down into the revenue adjustments lines, some of these we did have some nuance, as you recall, to the contractual adjustments other and bad debt, as we were trying to find out exactly how our change in collection process affected our numbers. And so for some of these, we had to go through and say, well, what's reasonable? It looks a little odd in 2021 actual, especially compared to 2020's actual and 2021's budget. So we did a blended approach, ended up at 54.6% for our revenue adjustments in total, which is more conservative than last year's budget by 0.5%. And it's more in line with where our runway rates were in 18 and 19 and 20. So we feel pretty good about that number, a little bit conservative, more conservative than the prior year budget anyways. Grants, $100,000 in grants. We probably will end up with more grant revenue than that. I think there's probably going to be a lot of grant revenue out there that we should qualify for and need to go out, find, and put our name out there and see if we can get it. For other revenue, that's predominantly made up of Port Ludlow Retail Pharmacy. That's about $1.4 million of the other revenue line. And then the rest of that is mostly cafeteria revenue. Cafeteria sitting at about $600,000, which is still less than our 2019 run rate. And then we do expect increases in 340B revenue, both at Port Ludlow Retail and then the other retail pharmacies that we worked with. I think we're also bringing another 340B pharmacy. I believe Don's Pharmacy is going to be 340B, which it was at one point, and it's going to move back to that. So we do expect an increase in 340B, which brings us to an overall increase of about $15 million for operating revenues. And then if we move to the next slide, we've got expenses. So first off, you'll see salary expense, pretty significant increase, almost $9 million, 12% for salaries. Part of that is we just expect that we're going to have to pay more for the staff that we do have. We've tried to build some of that in. 2020 actual is very difficult to model off of because of the amount of overtime that we have running through 2021. And so it's hard to ensure that we've got a good rate in there, but we have a higher rate than we did at the 2021 budget per FTE. It's about 10% higher. And then we also have additional FTEs. So there's two things running through there. And I think the hard part is we'll end up with the FTEs and probably paying a little bit less per FTE because we won't have as much overtime running through it, or we will have to have the overtime. And so we'll probably make it to that $77 million somehow, either through hiring people or overtime or increases for recruitment and retention. Employee benefits at 23.2, that's a pretty standard percentage number. There's not, as you go down the line, professional fees, purchase services are pretty, just slight increases from the run rate that we've had in 2021. Not too much excitement in those. We do have higher supplies, and some of that is pharmacy driven because we are expecting growth in pharmacy. And then a part of it is just inflation driven with supplies. So we ended up with a total almost 10% increase, $2.5 million increase to supply expense. Insurance, slight increase, leases, rentals, depreciation, and repairs and maintenance. We combed through all of those to make sure we have everything appropriately classified with the change from all leases now being capital leases. Sometimes people are still used to putting their operating budget request in with a lease, and so we need to make sure that we move that over into the capital side of things. So we've went through it. We think we've got all of those moved into the right spot, but that obviously has some impacts to our lease rental expense and our depreciation expense. And then the only other thing that I wanted to point out on this, so the other line is 932,000 higher than It was in 2021, the run rate that we have in 2021. This includes a lot of different items, but it includes things like CME, travel, training, you know, things that a lot of people have put off through the pandemic that we expect them to go and do their education, do their trainings. We also expect to have more in recruiting expenses. This is where recruiting gets lumped in. This is where dues and subscriptions and marketing also get lumped in. So as a lot of those expenses were put on hold or put on pause for a bit through the pandemic, those are going to have a little bit of a ramp up. Not the full amount, as I think it's going to get there's still going to be some things that are virtual and cost less because they're virtual, but we do still expect to have more spending in there.
Tyler?
I ask a question? Oh, go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, Tyler, why do we expect our utilities to be less next year than they have been in the last three?
That's a good question. We went through utilities and I had that. Let me make sure I get the right answer for that, because I asked that same question and got a response back. But I'll get that and send it to you.
I have a question for you, Tyler. Is the reimbursed employee patient responsibility, is that included in employee benefits?
It is included in employee benefits.
So that is in the budget?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. And if I might comment a little bit about the taxes, in the past, as I recall, it was under my understanding that the junior tax, there's only one big pie for the junior taxing districts of which we are a part. And so the more we took out, the less the others had to share. And so we made the decision not to increase if we could possibly help it, as they didn't have the opportunity or the wherewithal to make up the difference as much as we did. So that's why we are lower than probably most everyone else in the state. Those were conscious decisions we made way back, and I think that's part of why we're so much lower now, if I recall.
But weren't the other people in the same situation as us with the junior taxing districts? Weren't the other counties in the same situation?
I would imagine that the system is the same.
Yeah.
Well, at some point, it might be interesting to know what those figures are, and how does our taxing district compare in terms of size and options and constraints for other entities in the community.
I think that's a good idea too. This was way back, and it's probably not as relevant now as it was then.
And I'm asking the assessor's office a lot of questions regarding to the tax levy too. And so as I'm able to connect with them, I can always add that as a board education session before one of the commissioners' meetings.
Perfect.
And also, Jill, as part of the work that we are stepping into with,
Mary, Kona's Mary.
Yes, Mary Kay. Yeah. It is to better understand the whole community tax pie, for lack of a better term, and understand how it's split and where each agency rests with respect to being at their lid, and also part of my discussions with the city manager and the county administrator and the PUD exec with the school superintendent is to sort of plot out critical infrastructure, community infrastructure that needs to be reinvested in the next 3 to 5 to 10 years. Because I think that as one of those critical community institutions, we owe it to our community to stage that in a way that, and plan it community-wide beyond Jefferson Healthcare in a way that is sensible and supportable. Mm-hmm. So I have to just ask this, Tyler, and this would be really awesome if it were to be the case. We have been making a lot of investments in our infrastructure, our utility infrastructure, for the purpose of being greener and for the purpose of being more cost effective. That would be a walk-off home run to have that factor into a 10 to 15% reduction. According to Chris O'Higgins, who's been on that work for the last couple of years, we have made enough improvements and investments to where it should start showing up somewhere, just probably not that large.
Every bit helps.
Yep.
I do have one question, sort of comment. As I look at this, it appears that 2018, 19, 20, 21 have all been years in which we have a positive operating bottom line. Is that correct, the way I read this table?
Yes. So we have had operating income and net income for the past few years. So 2022, we are budgeting for $3.8 million about. So a little bit higher than our 2021 annualized actual, but a little bit lower than 2020 and 2021's budget. So think there's a good chance we could beat that number, but it is very variable.
So I'm wondering if this takes into account everything that has happened since the beginning of the pandemic in terms of loans, advance payments, need to pay back, and all of that. So am I misreading this positive bottom line too optimistically, or is that actually what this shows?
No, we ended up, I think the funds in 2020 for a lot of the CARES funds showed up as operating income. So those are going to be included in that operating line. And if we go to the next one, that'll show our total change in net position, which was also positive. So you can see in 2020, I mean, there's those CARES funds are sitting in the operating line. If those were in non-operating, what you would probably expect is that operating income was not actually achieved, that we were lower than we wanted to be. And that was because expenses were high when volumes were down in 2020. But the CARES funding is what got us there. And that does not include the CARES funding that we can include in our income statement and in our total net income line is only that we don't have to pay back. If you exclude the $18 million total that we received in 2020 that has to be paid back, we were still made whole via the rest of the CARES funding that came our way.
But your point is a good one, Case. Absent of the $9 million of CARES money in 2020, we would have lost $5.5 million off operations. And secondly, if I understand your question, we are taking into account in projecting 2022's change in net position, the amount of revenue that we have set aside for any continued payback. If we had not set the Medicare advanced payment money aside, it would be blistering our operations right now, because the way Medicare is paying that back is just by paying us the amount we get paid for Medicare services is just less. So organizations that don't have that extra money to offset that, in other words, that spent that early advance payment, they're probably in a bit of hurt right now, and they will continue to be. I think it's like middle part of next year, Tyler. When will all of that advance payment repayment cycle out?
We haven't projected how long it we expect to have payback, but it can go up to 17 months, and we started paying that back in April of 2021. So it may run all the way through 2022, or we may be done paying it a bit earlier.
Mari is dying to say something.
Well, I'm going to ask a question regarding when our numbers were down, our volume was reduced, and that affects us on our cost reports. So are we likely to receive more payment for that period, or are we going to be paying more back?
So,
or do we not know?
So we did receive a big Medicare check for the year 2020, but we're now expecting a large payback in 2021. And that's because now things have shifted again as our volumes have started to increase. And now they're paying us at a high cost rate. We're going to have a big payable at the end of the year. We're projecting that to be $3.3 million for 2021, and we've already accrued for over 75% of that. So.
Okay, thanks.
It's a great question, though, Mari.
Well, I figured this cost report business, which, I mean, I think we've gotten paid back already for 2013. It just boggles the mind that you can run a business with a system that's in place. Boggles my mind.
It is a very strange system, and it's strange that it takes them that long to finalize things. We just last month got paid something for 2017.
Yeah.
Oh,
now, is that the end of it, or are we still expecting? Because I knew there was another lot to come, but are we still expecting more for the 2017?
For 2017, it should be closed out and finalized now.
Okay, great.
We agreed with their adjustments and wrap that one up.
So what about 18 and 19?
They're still open. So we've received our initial payments, but they will go back. They'll do some reviews, some additional audits, and ask for copious amounts of materials. And then it may be plus or minus, you know, a couple hundred thousand, depending on what they find.
Yeah, thank you, Tyler.
So on this this section, we have the rest of the non-operating, and you can see we've plugged in the $11,000 extra into the 2022 budget for taxes, just assuming we're going to take the 1% or the extra $5,000. So we've got that. And we left interest income at the same as we had budgeted in 2021, even though 2021 actuals have been quite a bit low. I've actually reached out to talk about that as well. We have all of our funds in the local government investment pool, which has a extremely low rate right now. So even though lots of others are doing quite well with their investments, we as a public hospital district can only pretty much invest in CDs, treasury bills, or the LGIP account. And none of those are great choices for making any money on your investments. But we'll take the $50,000 we've gotten in 2021. And interest expense about the same, contributions about the same as well. Those were, I think, the only one running through, or the main one running through in 2022 is an expected donation from the Home Health and Hospice Foundation. So add that all together, we've got a budget of $3.8 million. That's positive net income and about a 2.5% operating and total margins. We do also have salaries and benefits as a percent of net patient service revenue, less than 65%. That's kind of industry standard is to keep that lower than 65%. So we're just a hair underneath where we should always be trying to keep that lower. And that rounds out the income statement.
So no Bitcoin investments, huh?
Yeah, not allowed to invest in Bitcoin or even the S&P 500.
I have a question.
Yep.
So salaries and benefits as a percent of net patient service revenue is below 65%, which you say is sort of industry standard, yet we have a benefit of $1.7 million that you say is completely unusual in the industry. Are we cutting somewhere else and we're adding this benefit? Or?
So an industry standard may not have been the appropriate word. It's more of your line you don't want to cross. It's that 65% is where you want to hold lower than that. And there's a lot of variability when you're trying to benchmark against others too in healthcare, because not all employ their doctors. And obviously provider expenses are gonna be quite a bit higher than other expenses. So ours at 65% is something that we strive for. And it's also, like I said, it's kind of that line in the sand that is out there of you don't want it to go higher than this, or else you may be in a little bit of trouble. Because that only leaves 35% for the rest of your operations.
All right, thanks.
Yeah, just to give you some context, the proprietary hospitals run at below 50%. And my experience with Providence is mid-50s. And those are, or certainly Providence, I think the proprietary hospitals notwithstanding, but Providence, those are organizations that have to compete in the same labor markets that we have to compete in. They just are far more focused on productivity, far more focused on, you know, on managing all the bits and pieces. Whereas we frankly aren't. And secondly, Matt, that $1.7 million, that was 2 years of worth of a number.
Thanks.
All right. Let's go to the next one, which is the start of the statistics. So first off, FTEs, we're budgeting for 674 FTEs. Our 2021 annualized, and this when we annualized the stats, it was later on than when we did our first annual of the financial numbers. So instead of being June 30th numbers, this is end of August numbers that we annualized, just to be clear. But our budget for FTEs was 625, and our actual is that we're running below budget for FTEs at 602. So those show up as negatives, because typically in a finance world, being lower than your FTEs is ideal state. In the current world we live in, that's not ideal state any longer. So instead of having those be negative and red, I've just left the coloring off of those, because we do want to fill those positions. We're actively trying to fill those positions. We would much rather be at 625 FTEs right now than 602. And our goal is to get to that 674 number for next year. And that's why we have the extra expense in for marketing, recruiting, stuff like that. Adjusted patient days, that number just continues to climb and climb. And what adjusted patient days is trying to do is give you a sense for, if you converted all of your outpatient days to a patient day, what would your total in and outpatient look like? And so as our outpatient side of the house continues to grow and grow and grow, and our inpatient side holds a little bit more flat, that number is just going to continue to really climb. And so it's sitting at 42,000, quite a bit higher than 2021 actual and budget.
Hey, Tyler.
Yeah.
So one thing I'd like to point out to the board that Caitlin has brought to our attention a handful of times, and I think if it probably demonstrates just the impact of all of the COVID-related FTE ads that we have made that may have little to do with operating the typical hospital, but as SLG will tell you, are sprinkled around the entire shop. If you look at the top line, the FTEs total go all the way across to 2019, and we'll use 2019 as the last of our fairly busy years. We're sitting at 573 employees in 2019. I don't think we suffered from the same staffing crunch then. Well, we have like, what, 27, 29 more employees this year than we had in 2019, and about the same as last year. So while it seems like there's been this, mass that our staffing shortage has been the result of bodies no longer in the workforce, that's not the case. I mean, we're holding steady to 2020 and a significant uptick from 2019. And I think if you'd ask anybody on this, or anybody in operations, they would say 2019 was a pretty busy year.
That was a good point, Mike.
Thank you.
All right. And as going through the rest of the inpatient side, you can see that some of those we've moved down from our 2021 budget, but we're higher than our 2021 actual. That's the case for both ACU and swing. So we probably had a little bit too aggressive of budgets for 2021, and so we've moved those down a bit. They're now somewhere between our 2020 and 2019 actuals. For ICU patient days, we are right on the 2021 budget. We do hope that that number drops from year-to-date actual annualized. The ICU has been quite busy, and you can see that 917 is 53 more patients in ICU that we saw in 2019. So we think that that's going to be a little bit closer to the 2021 budgeted number of 890. But an overall increase in patient days of 1% over actual and 14% less than 2021 budget. And then moving on to the next section there. So births 5% higher than actual, 17% lower than budget. Those surgery cases and surgery minutes. So surgery cases up 7%, but minutes only up 1%. That kind of gets us to a more surgery minutes or the minutes per case are much, much higher year to date than they were budgeted for and than we've seen in the past. So this just gets us a little bit more in alignment with where we've been. Special procedures, 4%. Lab is another one that's interesting. No increase from year-to-date actual, but you can see that number of 262,000 is significantly higher than our run rates in 2020 and 2019. So we're just kind of expecting that to hold steady and not see the same rampant increase that we've had. Blood bank units matched. I actually have a we've been trying to track down what's going on with this metric. This is a manually tracked one that we've had in our list in the past. But there's been some turnover in that department, and I think that the tracking is just not happening. When it comes to budgeting the revenue, we held that department at no growth from 2021 annualized. So we expect it to hold steady. But it does look a little funny having two dashes there instead of numbers. MRIs.
Tyler, may I ask, what does that mean? Blood bank units matched. Matched to what?
And that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I do know it's a manually tracked stat that that unit has had. And without anybody there, I don't know that
I can answer that question.
It's matched to a patient.
If you have a unit of blood, you have to type and match it. You have to figure out what kind of blood it is, whether it's A positive or B negative, and what the Rh factor is. And so I suspect that that's what that might refer to.
Yeah, yep. So if a patient needs a blood transfusion, then that's how the patient's blood is matched to the blood that we've got in the bank. And so if we've got a patient who needs two units of blood, well, they would match two units for that patient by testing the patient's blood with the blood that's been acquired from the Puget Sound Blood Bank.
And what effect does that have on our budget?
It costs money.
We probably get reimbursed for it. Mm-hmm. I would hope.
Yep. There is revenue and expense in that department. And so for revenues, as I said, we just held those steady from 2021 annualized for the budget purpose.
Okay. Thank you.
My question is regarding MRIs and CT scans. So mm-hmm. would because a lot of patients have unfortunately not been able to or chosen not to access care for various ailments during the pandemic, would we not anticipate more increases in those two situations particularly and in regular radiology diagnostic testing?
Yeah, so overall, we do expect the 2% increase to diagnostic imaging. We did just hire a new director for that area, and she was not here during the budget process. She came in right after. So what we tried to do was just match up what going through and looking at historically, where are we at? What does the market data show for all of these various procedures? And then I think there's probably going to be some capacity constraints as well regarding that. So even if there is pent-up demand, if we don't have the resources to be able to see all of the patients that we do have the pent-up demand for, it's going to be a little bit constrained. All of those numbers, if you look to, are considerably higher than they were in 2019. So you know, MRIs at 2,500 is 300 more than we did in 2019, and CTs almost 1,000 more than 2019. So those I'm trying to remember back to my notes if there was anything else going on, but that's what I can recall from total diagnostic imaging.
Yeah, I think it's a good, it's a fair question, Mari. We are the most likely way that 2022 will break is that it'll continue to return more to normal, and therefore unearth this significant pent up demand. So while it's probably fair to say most of the scenarios we looked at, we expected that, but we didn't want to balance the budget on it. I think there's still enough fog of COVID that makes us a little tentative, but you're exactly right. It's likely the problem we will be trying to solve is how do we accommodate, another 5 to 10% demand with real capacity limitations, which frankly, compared to the problems we've been grappling with the last couple of years, I look forward to that one.
Yeah, the thing is too, that a lot of these services are human dependent. So if we don't have the staff to extend maybe the service, instead of from 8 till 5, it goes from 8 till 8 or something like that, then it is a problem, I think, for healthcare all around right now, is getting enough, filling the 100 and odd spots that we need more staff.
Yep.
And would you mind saying something about the lab billable tests? And I'm wondering, are we being reimbursed for the lab tests that we're doing? I understand that there were some questions at some point that there wasn't going to be reimbursement for some of our COVID-19 work, and I don't recall if that was the lab testing or what.
So there was some concern around COVID testing, and what we have found, and I don't know if those run through, I don't believe they actually run through lab, on this budget line. But what we did find is, as long as all of the documentation is in there appropriately, we will be reimbursed for that. We did find there were some instances where the documentation wasn't quite correct, and that was flagged and changed, and we've been seeing reimbursement on those COVID tests. Sure.
Yeah, I think that the level of exposure that we experienced with an under reimbursement for testing was made up by local county, in this case, grant money and other grant money that came by way of rural health clinics. So I think whatever hole that was created has been filled by funding and by I think just billing systems on both ends.
And then just a quick procedural question, if you don't mind. Are we planning to take a coordinated break during this 3-hour session, or are we all going to get deep vein thrombosis from having sat too long?
Just wiggle your toes.
I'm afraid that doesn't count.
We could all stand up and jump up and down a few times.
Well, I would like
to. Or we could take a 5-minute break.
I think a 5-minute break somewhere along the line would be highly recommended.
We're probably I don't think that I could ever do a 3-hour meeting, but so I don't think we'll take the full time. So we probably are pretty close to the midway point. If this is a good spot before we move on to the next stat sheet, if everyone wants to take a quick 5-10 minute break.
Certainly. We'll go ahead and recess for 5 minutes, and we'll be back at 3:25.
Sounds good.
Okay. And for the rest of our deep dive budget meeting. Tyler, up to you.
All right. So first off, I was trying to look through my notes, Bruce, on utilities. And what I found that I have a question out just to confirm that this is right. But some telephone expense that we had running through utilities is now moved over to non-medical supplies. So it's sitting in a supplies account for the actual telephones. So I will get confirmation on that, but I think that explains why the big decrease there in utilities, just for the actual telephone devices.
Thanks.
My explanation is sexier, Tyler.
Your explanation is way better. I should have just left it with that.
Not true, but that'll be the next big reduction.
All right, and then if we finish this stat, so we can go on to the next one. Right, so first one on this list, pharmacy meds dispensed. This is another one where we probably had a budget that was a little too aggressive in 2021. So we've bumped that down, 6% increase over actual, but a 13% reduction in budget. Anticoag, we expect to be about where we've been. When you look at it, that's still about 200 higher than 2019. RT, we're expecting an increase, not quite to the level that we budgeted in 2021, but somewhere in between our 2021 actual and our 2019 actual. And similar for pulmonary rehab. And then when looking at the rest of the therapy, so we have PT up 10%, OT 2%, and speech therapy holding steady for an overall increase of 8% for that area. ER, we're expecting a little bit of a jump between our 2021 annualized run rate, but still not back to 2019 volumes. Same with Express, you know, a little bit of a jump, but not back to those 2019 volumes yet. And I think that for both of those areas, I think that folks are just accessing care a little bit differently than they have pre-pandemic, and we just expect those to persist into 2022. The rural health clinics going on down, it's 3-9% volume increases for each of them, and 6% overall for the rural health clinics, but only a 1% higher than what we budgeted for in 2021. Offsite lab is that COVID response where we would see the testing, vaccinations, other stuff like that. We do still expect to have some of that going on into 2022. So we're still budgeting for some activity in offsite lab. And then on to the next page. This is where we start looking at specialty clinics. Specialty clinics overall increased 14% from 2021 actual and 13% from 2021 budget. Going down the list, it's a pretty much, you know, increase in all areas. Cardiology, we're expecting it to be a little lower than the 2021 run rate. Sleep clinic visits are 9% lower than 2021. And if you recall, if we've looked at the finances month to month, sleep has been low, and it's been a provider constraint issue. They have hired, but they're still a little bit light on FTEs. So we still expect that to be a provider constrained area into 2022. But going down into the sleep center studies at 20% above, there is pent-up demand for sleep center studies. You can see that that's still lower than it was in 2020 and in 2019. Having that provider constraint for the sleep clinic visit is going to impact that number, but primary care can refer directly to sleep centers, so there could be some of that going on. So all that to say, those numbers look a little odd if you just pieced them together and looked at them, but there's something behind both of them that is leading us to believe they could be reasonable numbers for 2022. Infusion, 9% higher than our 2021 run rate. Surgery, endoscopies, 7% higher. Home health, 2%. Hospice, pretty much flat. That's back to where we were in 2019, even though hospice has not, it's been around that $12,000 to $13,000 range the last few years. So that's just about where we're at with a reasonable number of hospice census days. Cardiac rehab, 4% increase. Dietary total meals. So that stat is changing from total revenue to total meals in 2022, and that's why it looks completely different than what it's been in the past. Materials management, orders processed, basically flat, just a 2% increase from year over year. And we still have exercise for health at a zero volume for 2022.
So it's gratifying to see the women's clinic exceeding the 2021 budget that was quite aggressive to start with. So well done.
Yeah, women's clinic has their volumes have been looking really good.
Having waited 35 years to get the women's clinic going, I'm very gratified. Thank you.
You were right on that one, Mari, no doubt.
Hey, listen, women make all the most of the decisions in healthcare, and the population of this county is at least 50% women. So I'm glad that we're hopefully taking care of them now.
Yep. Hey, Tyler, if you were to convert, or had you not converted the dietary stat, and I think that's the right thing to do, but for the purpose of comparison, are we thinking Aaron's Cafe is going to drift more toward 2019 or still reflect a curtailment of non-employee use?
Yep. It's a conservative budget in terms of total revenue. It's sitting at about $600,000. So a little bit less than what we've done in 2021 annualized. And that annualized number probably looks a bit different with the employee appreciation discounts rolling through there. So, which would not have been the case when we annualized this number. It was not in there yet. So I don't know that we'll make it to 680 in 2021, and it's budgeted for about 600,000 in revenue in 2022. I think that's an area where we also will have to look at pricing, just with cost of goods going up at some point. That may have to change a little bit, but there's still a lot to work out in terms of overall employee discount, if it's even going to be open to the public, or if it's going to be employees only still.
And could you comment on exercise for health? Where are we in terms of our thinking about that particular program?
Well, I do not have any notes on exercise for health, actually. I just was told that it would more than likely not be open in 2022, but I don't have a good timeline or expectation of when that may be up and running.
Mike, do you happen to know if there are any thoughts about trying to start that up in 2022?
Not that I'm aware of, Case. It just hasn't been it hasn't made our clearly at some point we aren't discontinuing the service. I think that when it's deemed safe to provide that level of service and we retool it, we will. So I want to be careful that what we're saying is not interpreted as anything other than it will be one of the last services that we reintroduce to our community and patients because it's one of the most COVID sensitive services. But as soon as we get the all clear and we're convinced we can do it safely, we will resume that process.
Great. Thank you.
All right. And that rounds out the stats. So we move on. The next up is capital budget. On the next slide, we have kind of the different categories that we have put all of these in. And so there's routine replacement, new equipment, construction projects. The version I looked at this morning didn't have specialized furniture. I think somebody might have punked me and put specialized furniture in there. I'm not sure what that is, but we don't actually have that classification, although it sounds pretty cool. So we don't have any of that. We do have software and technology. So those are the different classifications that we have these broken out into. And on the next slide, you can see our 2022 to 2025. So the majority of what we have for equipment is replacement equipment. The big expenditures on here are the Philips monitors. We've got to replace a lot of Philips monitors throughout the ED, FBC, ACU, and ICU. We also have a couple air handler units that are spread out between 2022 to 2024, but we do have two of them that need replacing in 2022. The other expenditures that are pretty large. We've got a few running through lab. These are just replacements. And the defibrillator replacement is also pretty spendy. But overall, these are just items that are worn, past their useful life, items that we've probably, for some of them, even pushed off a little bit through the pandemic. And so we're putting them back on the list to get the replacements in. And then on the next page, we've got the new equipment and the construction. So new equipment, some of the cool items on new equipment, the Epic Rover, I think, is supposed to be allow for at the bedside documentation of labs and stuff like that. The Moleculite is supposed to be pretty interesting too. You can use it to see bacteria in a fluorescent way and be able to easily spotlight it. So those two items are pretty unique. The others, you know, generator tank, fuel scrubber, OB procedure table, and decon trailer, while all of those are necessary, they're not quite as exciting as Epic Rover or Moleculite. And then moving into construction, we do have the big thing that you see there in the over half of our total budgeted expense is the hospital replacement design fees. We know we will have design fees for the 1965 building replacement. We don't exactly know what we're going to be building quite yet, how much funding we will have, but we do know that there will be some design fees because we need the need to replace the building. So it's still, there's a lot TBD in terms of the building, but we know we need a new one and we know the process is going to start with those design fees.
So can I ask Tyler, what's going on in dental for construction?
You know, I didn't ask about that, so I don't know.
Additional storage space up in there. So they're just running out of all places to put the multiple dental supplies that they have to order.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jen.
So the design fee, they're largely a place saver. I mean, that we've talked about the need to get serious about the replacement of the 65 building, as well as planning and building additional space for many of the existing specialty services that we provide, and as well as new services that we would like to provide. So it's a function of just how much of that we take on. So given that we have some consultants beginning to to help us with that, and we will be engaging a construction or a contractor architect team to help us with that, we wanted to have the number in the budget, and when that becomes more clear, well, you will direct us kind of with a range of magnitude project, and when the design fee amount that's reflective of that size of project becomes more clear, we will fine tune that number.
All right. Thanks. And on the next slide, we have technology and software. So a lot of these, as you can see, there's a lot of different IT expenditures, which you'd expect in technology and software. We do have a new director in that department as well. He's said that he's working through these, and he would say that a lot of them are penciled in, but they're related to you know, infrastructure, security, and network upgrades and storage. So I asked him for the English version of what he had here, and that's what I got. But there's a lot of this that I think is still being worked on, and just making sure it aligns with his vision and what he sees is necessary. And there may be some of those that can be whittled a little bit down or used in a different manner. We also have some new software going in at the Port Ludlow Retail Pharmacy. That's being the accountant that helps out with Port Ludlow Retail Pharmacy has been helping them kind of review and vet that, make sure we can get everything we need from that in terms of a data perspective to do the accounting for them. So that will hopefully be a good upgrade for them in terms of the technology that they have over there. But overall, including that $3 million placeholder that we have for design fees, we're looking at 5.6 million, so 2.7 million in 2022, 328,000 in 2023, which I believe is just an air handler unit and that tank scrubber, and then another 1.1 in 2024 and 600,000 in 2025. So total spend over the next 4 years of about 7.8 million, but that does not include any construction of a new building past those initial design fees.
So Tyler, go ahead, Jill.
What constitutes the 1,136,450 in 2024? I don't see anything up there.
Yep. So that is the the big one is the replace 95 roofing, and there is another air handler unit and an MRI injector. And these are definitely not all inclusive, but we do ask the teams to try and do that 5-year lookout. We even we did not have anybody give any numbers for 2026. So, things changing as fast as they are, this is just our best guess for items we know we're going to need, and we'll fill in a lot of the details when we get further down the road for 2023 through 2026.
So you caught my earlier comment or wishful thinking that some of the utility drop in spend had to do with our investment in new technology and infrastructure. Every time we replace an air handler unit, and many of those were original install that sit on the 95 building, that we replace from a 20 plus old unit to a brand new state of the art unit, and so there's an incremental increase in efficiency and just how clean they work. We're replacing three of those darn things this year, and it seems like every year we replace a couple. Chris has been real diligent about putting us on that schedule. In addition to getting on the other side of the replacement curve, it would stand to reason that not only are we burning less less electricity, which is good for the environment, that our utility spend would go down too. Secondly, the Port Ludlow retail pharmacy software spend. When we bought this software, when we opened the Port Ludlow pharmacy up, we didn't really know much about the retail pharmacy business, and it could be argued, and I think has been argued by some of the staff out there, that wasn't the best software the best retail pharmacy software available. So we said, well, let's try to make it work, we just installed it, and maybe it's a matter of getting used to it. And to their credit, they tried. And to our credit, I think we recognize that even though we kind of thought this was going to last 5 to 10 years, it's not working and needs to be replaced this year. And lastly, you know how I like to share sound bites for you in the event that members of the community question you about things like charges or in this case, bottom line, that you'll note that even if you pull the $3 million number out a place saver for potential building design, plus or minus $500,000, our bottom line is about what our capital investment is. And so that it's important for a couple of reasons why why a hospital generates a bottom line, but one of those reasons is we are a very labor-intensive industry and a very capital-intensive industry. And with prior to funding our depreciation, which Tyler has us doing now, we relied on our bottom line to fund capital improvements.
Thank you, Mike.
That's a great point, Mike. And when I looked at our previous spend, too, just for a frame of reference, it seemed like 2.7 to 3 was about where we are for capital spend, or where we have been over the past few years. So I think we've, even with the items that have been put on pause, we still have a reasonable amount of spend rolling through in 2022. And that's it. Any questions or any items that I think we tried to get to all of your questions real time, but is there anything else outstanding or anything that you would like me to clarify before the budget hearing or during the budget hearing next week?
Case?
Yeah, there's, you know, right at the very beginning, you had this very impressive slide of the 2019 and 2020 charity care, uncompensated care, employee responsibility write-offs. That's the one. And I wonder if you could say more. You said that some of that uncompensated care bad debt was actually covered. But I missed exactly how that fits in, whether what is ultimately covered is part of that 7 million, or is this the part that the bad debt that is never collected?
No, so this is just our total uncompensated care number. For Medicare bad debt, that is part of our cost report. So we do send in our Medicare bad debt and say for Medicare patient responsibility, only Medicare, not for those that are dual eligible. Here's our total amount of bad debt, and they will audit that number, and they'll do a test of all of our accounts. We'll have to send in information. We have to show that we truly did try and collect. There's certain timelines that we have to try and collect. So they'll look at all of that, and then they'll say yes or no, and then they'll extrapolate the error. They'll say, here's the total bad debt that we'll give you credit for, and we will give you some compensation for that. And it's I think it's 55 cents on the dollar for that Medicare bad debt. So they don't make you 100% whole, but they try and give you some additional funding for those that you tried to collect on and were unable to. But it is, there's a very specific process for it. There's a lot of rules, a lot of regulations. You have to try and collect. They say that you cannot use a token collection effort, and they are the judge of what constitutes a token collection effort. So.
And so that 55 cents on the dollar that we get, that is not included. All of that process is not included in this $7 million.
No, so there's a portion of that bad debt that's going to be Medicare. And then of that portion, after it's audited, we would receive funding back on it. But I don't have the breakout exactly of, you know, $7 million and $3 million is Medicare, so we got $1.5 million back. I don't have that math, but I can work that out if that's important.
Yeah, I think that'd be helpful. If you could share that next week, that'd be fine.
Okay.
So, Tyler, if we didn't make any efforts to collect, then we wouldn't get anything, correct?
Correct.
And so
Medicare would not allow it as a bad debt.
Okay. So we'd lose basically $3.5 million if we didn't make any effort.
Just a portion of that. So that total, because that $7 million of uncompensated, that includes those that did not pay and did not meet our charity care criteria. If regardless of if you had Medicare or if you had Blue Cross or Aetna or whatever the case may be, or if you did meet charity care criteria, then you're in that first bucket. You're in that free and discounted care. So the $7 million is going to be not all Medicare bad debt.
Okay. So I think you said it was about half of that was Medicare.
That's my rough guess. Okay. Just based on our payer mix.
Okay. And so just to keep on the Medicare subject, so $3.5 million roughly Medicare. And if we made no effort to go after it at all, we would just lose that outright. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then, so the efforts that are made to try and recoup some of that money, is there any sort of, have any idea how much that costs in staff time and effort?
Yeah, we do have multiple financial counselors. We also, for patient responsibility, some of those get kicked over to a third party that is working those accounts too. And so if that third party is successful on collecting, then they get a portion of it. If they're unsuccessful, then they kick them back to us, and then we send it off to Medicare. So there's staff time, there's third party contract time, and there's also just the time on the back end to make sure that we have all of these in the appropriate buckets so we can put them on our Medicare cost report and send it off to Medicare.
Wow. So 55 cents if we're fortunate enough to get through that. So interesting. So with the 6 million free and discounted care, which is charity care, that's just a write-off period.
Right. We do not receive any funding for that. That is,
but that's mandated,
just like a lot
isn't
of healthcare,
it?
It's subsidized via other means.
Okay, but that's mandated to at least 300% of poverty, correct?
Yes.
And we allow up to 400% of
correct
poverty. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. Thanks for asking that question, Case. That's really, it's quite staggering, the cost to try and get something of the $13 million that we're not paid for.
Well, I think the bigger point is that there's some discretion how an organization classifies its debt owed to it by its patients, particularly after insurance pays, but not a whole lot of discretion. And secondly, that clearly the system incentivizes an organization having policies and practices of trying to seek compensation or trying to seek payment from those it deems have the ability to do so. Because it seems a little counterintuitive if you're thinking about Medicare and how they keep hospitals whole, you think that they would want to incentivize free care, charity care. Yeah, you're taking care of those without means, so we're gonna allow a mechanism in your cost report to give you a percentage of what you write off. But they don't. The incentive is we realize that every hospital will take care of those that don't have the means to pay for that care. And there are, state requirements in most cases to mandate that. However, that in terms of Medicare reimbursement policy, we expect you to do a good job of seeking reimbursement from those you deem have the ability. And by virtue of when you try every reasonable take every reasonable recourse to get reimbursement for those services, and you're unable to, they will allow you to get credit for a percentage of them in your cost report. I think sometimes when we talk about this issue, it's presented as it's just one big moral judgment that we control. And the truth of the matter is there are a lot of big dot incentives and little dot incentives to move forward with this. And lastly, you know, these are big numbers. What the hell do they mean? You know, what does 6 million and 7 million mean? Well, I'll tell you, I'm looking at Olympics provision for bad debt and charity care for 2020 and 2019. And, you know, this is an organization with $440 million of revenue. And in 2019, their actual was $3.3 million provision for bad debt, $2.4 million charity care. And in 2020, $2.7 million bad debt, $3.1 million charity care. So you add that up and it comes out to about $12.5 million, which is $500,000 less than Jefferson Healthcare gives in those two buckets. So if sometimes I have to, that we have an oversized footprint in these two areas by nearly every measure, and we need to, that needs to be communicated in a way that we feel good about and not you know, in a way we don't.
So can I ask Mike, so are they paying for their uncompensated care by the fact they get four times or 10 times the amount of taxpayers' money that we get?
That's how they're paying for it, yeah, but the amount they write off it isn't offset by that.
Crazy. So what happens with private hospital, you know, private for profit or is the same system involved there?
Yeah, and it's...
Or do they not see Medicare patients?
I mean, you can technically, if you are a certain facilities, you could just say that you're not going to. But it's the way that healthcare works in general is a lot of you know, service lines will subsidize other service lines, and payers will subsidize other payers. So with the payments we receive from a commercial insurer, they're what's going to give us some of the cushion here, or the 340B revenue that we get for 340B is what makes up a lot of our bottom line too. So there's these different ways of kind of cross subsidizing, and a lot of other facilities are going to make this up via commercial payers that are just going to pay them more for the same services.
Yeah, so they have bigger volumes of commercial payers than we do, probably.
Oh yeah, we have a very what I think would be considered a poor payer mix for a lot of hospitals, and if we were not critical access, it would be very difficult to make this possible with our payer mix. We have a lot of Medicare and a lot of Medicaid.
Olympic may be worse payer mix than us. It's remarkable what they do out there. I want to be clear that when I made the comment about our charity care and bad debt versus theirs, wasn't at all suggesting they have an undersized footprint. That I think is a function of ratios. That would be about what you would expect. The point I was trying to make is that we have an oversized footprint in these two areas. And secondly, they have a 340B program, and Eric Lewis and now Daryl Wolf, very effective at advocating Washington D.C. and Olympia for, you know, for, we like to point to the dental clinic as as a way in which we were able to meet community need by help of, in this case, state government. Well, they can point to a bunch of real smart and thoughtful programs that they've been able to benefit from to continue to meet the need. So, you know, you've seen one rural hospital, you've seen one case of how a rural hospital meets the needs of their community and stays in business, but they do an outstanding job.
Thanks.
So, Mike, I have a question.
Yeah.
So back when I did some energy conservation work stuff for Bonneville Power, they had in their rates, you know, with all the utilities, that they had to have, you know, energy conservation programs that then the utilities had to go out, like the PUD, and work with, you know, industry, the schools, other hospitals and stuff on energy conservation programs where they actually gave incentives and rebates for installing variable speed air handlers, let's say, or, you know, more efficient lighting or more efficient motors or pumps and things like that. And I mean, this might be more of a question for Chris, but are they still doing that?
That's a great question for Chris. I'm gonna ask. I think it's about time that we bring Chris back and have him talk about his work and where it's going, and then maybe see if and answer those type of questions, and then maybe see if there is a return that we're able to calculate, because I'm familiar with those programs too, Bruce. I think that there's been less money in those budgets as of years past, but there still must be some. So it's probably something we should learn more about.
Okay, thanks.
Anybody else?
I do believe that the PUD is currently looking at the contract with Bonneville, and there are people that are considering recommending that they not sign with Bonneville because the rates might be significantly lower going with solar and wind as opposed to hydro. The projections are for the next 10 years or so. And the contract with the PUD for Bonneville would be a 20-year contract that you cannot get out of. And so this might be a good time to look at. Maybe we should see if we can invest in more solar and how about a wind turbine on top of the hospital.
You have to be really careful. I mean, that's how a lot of companies went out of business, and they thought they could get it cheaper than from Bonneville Power. That's how Georgia Pacific went out of business up in Bellingham. So you just have to be careful. I mean, Bonneville's still the big player in it, and they generally control the rates.
I think the state of Texas got into a little bit of a problem too with having their own system and not relying on other systems. So when they had that big freeze last year, they ran out of power.
So if I could get back, sorry, I might have brought up a red herring there. I don't think that's in our job description to be setting the contracts for PUD. But I do have one additional question, which is that I know that we've been talking, and I really appreciate all of the discussions we've had about charity care, bad debt, and all of that. And I do want to, first of all, second what Mike said, which is that I don't think people really appreciate and understand the amount of charity care and bad debt that we write off. And I think we all should continue to educate our constituents to that fact. My question does link to projections for next year, because we had discussed whether or not we were going to continue our current practice of not sending folks to collections until we have a further discussion about that. And I wonder how that has weighed into setting the budget for next year. And then also, Tyler, you said that we have this third-party contract. You're referring to a collection agency, or are there other entities that are working on trying to reconcile some of that uncompensated care?
So it's a company that we use that is not considered a collection agency. So they do not, you know, there's no impact to your credit or anything. It's basically outsourced self-pay collection. So they would do the same that our internal employees would do, where they would just, you know, call, talk about the statements. They're required to do the same four statements, I think. Mm-hmm. And then if there's no collection that has occurred, then they just kick those accounts back to us. So it's very low intensity. It's the same as if a Jefferson Healthcare staff were to do that, except for we don't have enough staff, so we outsource that. But we are considering insourcing in the future. So that's something that's on the table of maybe that service we want to bring back in-house.
So that's basically we're maintaining full control over those accounts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great.
The important distinction, Case, is that throughout the last 10 years or so, we've gone in, we've done that work in-house, outsourced, in-house, outsourced, but it's basically the seeking payment as it's owed to us. Then in the past, when we've concluded that our system isn't working and we now need to turn it over to collections, which we lose complete control over, and then it has all the other implications we've talked about, that's the part that we have stopped doing. So no risk of damaging credit rating and all that other nefarious stuff that sometimes happens when that occurs.
Good. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Well, the second part of Case's question, while I don't think Tyler and I talked about this specifically, but I'm assuming that that the budget reflects status quo. We didn't make a change that would indicate we were changing our policy in this year's budget. But we still plan on having the discussion. Is that fair to say, Tyler?
Yeah, so overall, we're expecting between bad debt and charity care, those two to equal $7.5 million in 2022. We budgeted for more bad debt than we have 2021 actual. And the reason for that is because we've changed our collection process, which has led to some issues just from a reporting standpoint of knowing where we stand, we expect there to be some outstanding aged patient responsibility that probably needs to be cleaned up. So we do have a little bit more in the bad debt section for 2022, just because we think that there's probably some old patient accounts that we will not be collecting on.
Thank you for clarifying.
Yep.
Anything else? Any other questions or comments? Great report, Tyler. I think that this was an excellent, worthwhile deep dive, and I, for one, gained a lot of knowledge and that I hadn't had before. So thank you very much.
I would agree. I think good job, Tyler. It's challenging times for all. You know, I grew up with a brother, a CPA with PricewaterhouseCoopers. So I you know, you must see numbers in the night. But it really is good from from a personal point of view, to have this in-depth dive and learn a lot more about how it's put together and also how we can continue to take care of our patients. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else? All right, then could we, I would entertain a motion for conclusion of this meeting.
So move.
So move.
Okay, I'm going to say Mari moved and Bruce seconded. Any discussion? All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay, all right, we'll see you next Wednesday.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great job. Bye-bye.